On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barbaric is the word out of Iraq today, as in barbaric torture of two captured U.S. soldiers. Their unrecognizable bodies apparently recovered Monday night south of Baghdad at the end of a road so booby-trapped with bombs it took 12 hours for a recovery team to work its way to the brutalized bodies. This is hard for all Americans to hear. Hardest for soldiers in the field where death and mayhem are daily companions. Most can take it, some cannot. A new report says a recruit-strapped U.S. military is sending mentally unfit troops into the fray, suicidal soldiers who are a danger to themselves and to their fighting comrades. Up next on Point, the hell of war, the troubled minds of soldiers, and the conflict in Iraq. I want to turn first today to Baghdad and Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been following the story of the two U.S. soldiers who were kidnapped south of Baghdad last week. Scott Peterson, thanks for joining us. What is known about what happened to these two troopers?
Well, it sounds like they were kidnapped. Of course, we knew that this was a claim by al-Qaeda in Iraq and also by a broader Mujahideen Shura Council. They had captured these two soldiers. It was clear that they were hoping to exact revenge on these two soldiers and on American forces in Iraq for the killing of their leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, last week. So this was, and I think that this is what we've seen played out. These two men were found brutally tortured and killed, and it really took apparently 12 hours for U.S. forces to get through the ring of booby traps and the ring of explosives around those bodies before they could even get there.
Scott, how did it happen that they were vulnerable to kidnapping? We hear talk of a change in policy so the U.S. troops are not out in small groups vulnerable to that kind of incident.
Well, this is something the military has made a very large effort to prevent from happening. Of course, they know that it doesn't take more than one or two videos really telling vital and violent videos to undermine all the positive aspects of what happened last week with Zarqawi, for example. And so they have made every effort to make sure that groups of soldiers go out in large numbers, or even if it's a squad level, that they've got military backup, serious hardware backing them up to enable them to fight out of any situation. What happened in this case was that there were three Humvees at a single checkpoint. Two of them pulled away in the course of an initial attack by insurgents, but then a second wave of insurgents came and basically attacked the third Humvee before it could join the others. But a mistake, and one that we very rarely see during U.S. Operations here.
Blessedly, this has been a rare event in this conflict, but gruesome one. Do you have a sense of how U.S. troops in Iraq are taking this on board, how they're absorbing this incident, Scott?
Well, I think that this is something that has always been at the forefront of the minds of U.S. military forces that I've certainly dealt with in Iraq. They always knew that if they were to be captured in this manner, that they would probably die in this manner. Very few people, I think, on the ground who are dealing with the brutalities of the conflict that is going on in Iraq now would have thought that these Americans could have been freed, that they would have been released, that they could have been negotiated for or paid for. That is not the point of the people who were kidnapping them. Their point is to demonstrate a type of viciousness and brutality. They're trying to measure up to the legacy, if you will, of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and this is one of the ways they have begun to do that. It was a gift to them.
Scott Peterson in Baghdad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Joining me now from Hartford, Connecticut, is reporter Matt Kaufman. He's co-author of an investigative series by the Hartford Current newspaper, headlined Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight. Matt Kaufman, thank you for joining us.
Sure, glad to be here.
We're going to hear in this hour from veterans, veterans of the Gulf War, veterans of the Iraq War, families who have lost loved ones in Iraq. You and your co-author, Lisa Chedekel, dug deep into this issue of the mental health of American soldiers. Take us into what you found, Matt. I mean, war is hell. It's got to be hell. It's hell physically on people. It's got to be hell mentally on people. Did you find something amiss beyond what would be a reasonable expectation of the mental strain of war?
Sure, because one of the things we looked into was not only what goes on in theater, but what happens before troops are deployed, sort of before the hell of war. And overall, what we found was that the military increasingly was sending, keeping, and recycling troubled troops into the war zone, sometimes in violation of their own policies.
What's the evidence of this, Matt?
There were two things. We sort of took a two-pronged approach, one looking anecdotally and one sort of looking systemically and statistically. And anecdotally, we sort of set out to look at, you know, what would be, if there were sort of mental problems, what would be sort of the most tragic end point of that. And we looked at suicides, and that, in fact, is what the military itself earlier had looked at to sort of gauge how good their mental health services were. And we were able to identify most of the suicides from 2004 and 2005 and got some military investigative reports on them, talked to scores of family members, and some troubling trends started to appear that a number of the folks who committed suicide in theater had given pretty clear signs that they were in mental distress and they didn't get the help they needed.
There's been a backstory of suicide running beneath this Iraq war, numbers pretty high in the first period of the war that got the military's attention and the attention of the press. What have those numbers looked like over the arc of this war?
Right. In 2003, I think there were 25 suicides, that may be just among Army, among a pretty hefty numbers there, and that was enough that the military, after a couple of spikes in 2003, to recognize that they may have a problem there, and they sent in a bunch of combat stress teams and tried to work on reducing the stigma of seeking mental health treatment in theater. And the numbers did come down in 2004. Now, some people think that had to do with this anti-malarial drug they weren't using anymore, but nevertheless, the numbers did come down in 2004. By about half, to about 12. And in 2005, there was a pretty dramatic turnaround back up to 22 in the Army against a smaller fighting force and actually a higher suicide rate in 05 than at the beginning of the war that had sparked the concern among military leaders.
You report on remarkable levels of stress in a war, obviously. I mean, we've just seen this latest example, this terrible kidnapping and torture mm-hmm. and killing. But these are soldiers who are not behind traditional lines. They're in urban guerrilla warfare, insurgency. They're up under stress all the time. You describe a situation in which antidepressants, Prozac and Zoloft and just all the rest seem to be just raining down on these troops. What's the policy there? Who gets them? Who uses them? And what's the impact of a soldier at war in combat, guerrilla war situation on antidepressants?
Yeah. Well, we did find that the number of troops who developed trouble in theater and some who had trouble beforehand, rather going over there on antidepressants like Zoloft or were being prescribed them, often the military, if they see some signs of combat stress, will sort of pull a soldier offline for 72 hours, what they call three hots and a cot, and give them a decent place to sleep and a warm shower and some decent food, and often put them on antidepressants, and then after 3 days sort of send them back to the war zone. And we talked to a lot of people who said that was not, therapeutically maybe the best idea, that the current class of antidepressants often don't work. Don't even begin to work for several weeks. And in addition, there's a warning on every antidepressant on the market today that says when a dose is started or changed, patients need to be monitored closely for increased suicidal or violent thoughts. And we found soldiers were not getting that sort of close monitoring and found a number of cases where soldiers put on antidepressants ended up killing themselves.
Share with us the story, if you would, of Trooper Henthorne, one of those that you describe in your series. What happened there?
Right. Jeffrey Henthorne from Choctaw, Oklahoma, had gone over for a tour of duty and had come back and had developed some pretty serious problems and was sent back over there. Now, the military knew that he had sort of had two episodes of suicidal behavior, one in which he locked himself, in a latrine for an extended period of time and had talked about harming himself, and a commander was finally able to get him out of there. But even after two suicide threats. He was still there, was still, you know, close enough to a gun that that last year he ended his life in theater.
At his own hand. Are U.S. troops being sent out against the military's own regulations here? We know recruiting has been tough. We know people are going for multiple tours of duty. Are we as a country sending out troopers who should not be sent out by the military's own standards or not?
I mean, right. And we looked at the military standards and decided, you know, it's the use of antidepressants and sort of at what point does a mental illness make you unfit for a job? You know, those are difficult calls to make. And so what we looked at is, well, all right, what has the military itself said is the standard for mental fitness? And there are, you know, the papers in the Defense Department that say that antidepressants for certain ailments, including moderate depression, are inappropriate for extended deployments. And we found that, in fact, that was happening.
We're joined now from Washington by Steve Robinson, 20-year military veteran, a Gulf War vet, former Ranger. He is now Director of Government Relations at Veterans for America in Washington. Steve Robinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I think people are going to listen and wonder right away whether this critique, this whole debate, is a proxy debate about the war itself. Is this an anti-war cry being raised here of concern over mental health?
Well, it's not for us. We are really concerned with the causes, the conduct, and the consequence of war. We're concerned about having healthy warriors on the battlefield and providing them the appropriate care when they come home. Should they need to redeploy to the war, the appropriate care to go back to the battle if necessary. So for us, it does not concern us about whether the war is right or wrong. We're focused on the troops.
The military is saying it's doing more than has ever been done. I'm looking here at a statement from William Winkenwerder, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. And by the way, we invited him on. He could not make it. But he has been quoted as saying, "I think it would be a fair assessment to say that this military has done more for the mental health of our service members than any other military in the history of the world." Steve Robinson, that's a big claim.
Well, I would think it would be fair to say that this war has been different than any war we have fought since Vietnam, and it requires an extraordinary effort to meet the challenges that the soldiers face. So in one sense, he's right, but it also demonstrates just how serious these problems are.
What are you hearing from soldiers in the field? Do they feel supported on the mental health front, or do they feel forced into this battle when they're not in shape to do it?
Well, we think that this issue it really revolves around stigma, the ability for soldiers to come forward and seek help and not be criticized, demoralized, or thought of as not having intestinal fortitude or somehow have a lack of character. This problem is no different than injury from a bullet or a bomb. It is well defined. In fact, the Institute of Medicine recently just validated the DSM-4. It's not voodoo science. It's a real injury. So the problem is changing the military's culture to recognize that this is a battlefield injury that must be addressed on the battlefield and then proactively when soldiers come home.
I can imagine Americans sitting back at home, Steve Robinson, not knowing quite how to respond to this, thinking, well, it's a gruesome, tough war. If you're going to fight it, of course there are going to be mental health issues that come out of it. So deal with it, soldier. What do you say to that response?
Well, we agree that there will be these injuries on the battlefield. As far back in history, you can find this problem on the battlefield. The question is now, are we smart enough to recognize that it's happening? And when we do identify people with mental health care problems, is our military so strapped in manpower that we must then take that person who's at even increased risk for hurting themselves and sending them back to fight again? I think that's the question we need to ask. And the Hartford Current series really exposes something that most Americans don't know. The 1% of our population that's serving in this war has served once, twice, three times. I've met a guy that served five times. Something bad will happen when you're re-exposed to trauma that way over and over, and it requires a response. And America has to ask itself, is our military stretched so thin that we will send mentally ill soldiers back to fight?
Matthew Kaufman, have you found that? Recruiting has been tough. Soldiers have been sent back again and again. Are we at this point essentially sending spent soldiers back who are at heightened risk of mental health problems because they've just been burnt out by this war.
Yeah, I mean, I think Steve is right. There's no question that that war is difficult for almost anyone, and that multiple deployments are it just makes sense, going to increase the risk to soldiers' mental health. The extent to which it is happening, I mean, that is difficult to say. But certainly, the more there are multiple deployments, the greater the risk. And you know, the military has done some studies of its own on the mental health of soldiers at pre-deployment. And their own psychiatrists came up with, about 9% that they found sort of had diagnosable mental health issues, you know, not necessarily deeming them unfit for duty, but at least having some questions there. We found, though, that Congress in 97 had insisted on a mental health assessment for all deploying troops to determine, look, is this guy or woman okay to go over?
So are they getting that assessment before they go?
Some are, but only fewer than 1 in 300 were getting a mental health assessment from a mental health professional before they were going over. So a third of 1% compared to the 9% that the military itself suggests may have a problem.
How do they identify who may have a mental health issue before going to war?
There is Congress in 97 had insisted on a mental health assessment for all troops, and some in Congress thought that meant sort of some sort of face-to-face encounter with a mental health professional. What the military has been doing is on a pre-deployment form that all soldiers fill out. There's a single question. Have you sought, during the past year, have you sought counseling or care for your mental health? On the basis of that question, only about 3% of soldiers answer that yes. And some congressmen have said, you know, I don't know what the right answer is. Maybe if you say yes, that's a good thing that you're seeking care. Maybe if it's the people who say no, we need to be looking at closer at, but of about 3% of those answer yes. But even among those, fewer than 7% of that 3% were getting a mental health evaluation. So very, very few people are actually getting something face-to-face with a mental health professional to determine, okay, there may be a problem here. Is this man or woman fit to go over or a danger to himself and a danger to others?
It's a tough war when 1% of the population is doing the fighting. Maybe, as Steve Robinson says, it's incumbent on the rest of us to ask if they're being sent out with the right support, with all we can do for them. Liz is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Liz, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say thank you to the Hartford Current for the series that they ran and support the statements that Steve Robinson has made. My son was one of those who was deployed having checked his pre-deployment medical assessment form that he had, in fact, sought mental health counseling at the post that he was deployed from in the year prior to his deployment, and his death has been attributed to a suicide while serving in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And my concern is, just as you heard, when there are those who do identify themselves, the military has said that it would garner at minimum a screening and then, if necessary, an assessment. Neither of those things happened for my son, and I know that that is the case for many, many, many of the military being deployed, just as you heard earlier from the Hartford Current.
Liz, we're sorry. We are sorry for that loss to you and to your family. Did your son express this problem to you? Did he say, "Mom, I'm having problems here, and I'm not getting supported," or did he keep it to himself?
He did not give us any indication at all that there was anything that was going on. In fact, his last letters home were all focused on the fact that he was up for promotion and the kinds of things that he was anticipating doing when he got home. And he had a list of things that he had sent us that he was asking us to send to him.
I'm sorry for what happened. Like you, grateful for the reporting into this. It helps us understand what's going on. Liz, thank you very much for
thank
your
you.
Call.
The other piece that I would
yes,
really
please.
Like for you to follow up with the Current on is those soldiers who have come home, who have committed suicide, and then don't appear on any part of the military's roster for suicides.
I will ask Matthew
thank
about
you.
That right now. Thank you for calling, Liz. Matt Kaufman, what about the suicide numbers from Iraq and then back at home? The military, as I understand your reporting, doesn't formally report any of these.
Right. The military does not identify suicides.
It's just non-combat deaths, I guess, under that broad umbrella, right?
Right. And then we were able to sort of do some parsing and identify the likely suicides and then confirm those through reports or talking with family. There is at least obviously every fatality in Iraq or Afghanistan or Kuwait is going to be recorded and by the military. That is not the case with the suicides and other deaths that occur once soldiers have come home. And so there is anecdotal evidence of a fair number of suicides among returning troops, but it's difficult to get an exact number on.
I want to turn to a veteran of the Iraq War now. He's joined us before, and we appreciated his candor then and look forward again today. Retired Command Sergeant Major Mike Lopez joins us from Fort Drum, New York. He was with the 2nd Battalion, 15th Field Artillery in Baghdad, deployed twice to Iraq from March 2003 to June of that year, and then again from June 2004 to June 2005. Sergeant Major Mike Lopez, thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You hear the reporting that the Hartford Courant has done here. Steve Robinson's speaking to us as well, and of course he did a lot of work on Gulf War syndrome after the earlier Gulf War. You were there. You've been candid about your own post-traumatic stress issues after you came back to the United States. What's your sense of it, Mike Lopez? Are American soldiers in the field in Iraq getting adequately screened and adequately cared for on the mental health front before they're at war and while they're at war?
I think so. I think that the systems are in place, but a lot of this has to do with the chain of command, and we all know that discipline, chain of command, and caring of soldiers differs from unit to unit. We would like to think that the standard is the same, but it's not. So some units, chain of command, take a more vested interest in what happens to their soldiers than others. And also, it's the soldiers themselves. They have to be encouraged. This has to be embedded and has to be followed up by that chain of command, because that soldier has to feel that he can come forward at any time and say, I've got issues with what we're doing and I need to see someone about it.
You were in command of hundreds of soldiers in Iraq. Did you see these kind of issues arise among your troops?
Yes, we did in several situations. But we had a good chain of command, a good atmosphere, good command climate within our unit. So if there was a soldier who came forward, and sometimes they wouldn't come forward, they would tell a peer, and then that peer would notify the chain of command, we would immediately take that soldier out of combat and get an assessment done either by the chaplain or behavior health, which we had on Camp Liberty there in Iraq.
Steve Robinson, you're tracking this closely from stateside. Does this sound typical? When American soldiers raise issues about their own mental health or those of others fighting next to them in Iraq, is what Mike Lopez is describing sort of standard, that they're, you know, picked up, cared for, that these issues are given the proper appropriate weight?
Well, I totally agree with him. It's a leadership issue, and I don't mean to say that every commander out there is ignoring this issue, but many are, and they are because they're concerned about having the appropriate amount of soldiers on the battlefield, and they just can't afford to let some people go. Even the Department of Defense, Mr. Winkenwerter, mm-hmm. Other people in Health Affairs, Colonel Elsbeth Ritchie, they've admitted publicly that soldiers with certain mental health care problems are being redeployed. The Sergeant Major is right. Leadership can solve a lot of these problems. But, you know, one thing to remember is that returning veterans who come back from Iraq, statistically and scientifically, are at a higher risk for self-medication, abuse of alcohol and drugs, unemployment, homelessness, incarceration, suicide. It's already a scientific fact. It's well documented. We've got 25 years of experience after Vietnam. So if we know that that is what happens when people come back or while they're on the battlefield, then we need to ratchet up the care and the screening of soldiers to make sure that we have the healthiest warrior on the battlefield. I know the Sergeant Major would agree that we want healthy warfighters on the battlefield.
Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. Ben is on the line. Hi, Ben, you're on the air.
Hello. I just want to make a comment. In the Washington area, we have, and I have personal knowledge of four suicides that took place at Walter Reed from veterans who returned from Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Are you a veteran? Are you medical staff? How would you know that?
I'm a veteran, but and actually, I'm a personal friend of someone who is on the medical staff and who took care of one of these people on the psychiatry ward. But the issue is that that was in the press. You know, nothing really came of it, at least in terms of the Washington Post. There was never a big follow-up article. But I think the point is, and I'll support the last comments and also the support of the comments of the sergeant major, that all these things are known and processes are in place, but the problem with this war particularly is it's being fought by reservists whose families and the reservists themselves are not familiar with the military. The units aren't familiar with them, and before they're deployed, they're not really familiar with the Army, or more to the case of the point is the Army more than the Marine Corps.
So they're not ready for what's coming. Have you served in Iraq, Ben?
Yes.
And what did you see there on this front? Did you see men, women under, all war is a stress and a strain. They don't say war is hell for nothing, but did you see something going on in Iraq beyond what's reasonable to expect on this front?
Well, I think I did see it more in reservists and that in active guard that they were, you depend on your unit. I mean, it's certainly not as bad as what my relatives told me is in Vietnam. I mean, with people rotating, every 11 months. But still, the structure there, I think your own doubts about necessarily what your mission might be and not being familiar with your cohorts, that is sort of a setup for the stresses that sort of precipitate this type of behavior.
Ben, we hear it. I want to thank you for your call. We're joined right now from Choctaw, Oklahoma, by Warren Henthorne, an Air Force veteran, father of Army Specialist Jeffrey Henthorne, who was with the 24th Transportation Company. He shot himself on February 8, 2005, in Balad, Iraq, 2 months into his second deployment. His family waited 14 months for an investigative report into their son's death. Warren Henthorne, we're sorry for the loss your family's taken here, and we thank you for joining us today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
How do you feel about what happened with your son? Was he properly cared for by the U.S. military?
No, he wasn't. There was, after looking in hindsight about what happened, I would suspect the chain of command in his company was dysfunctional. They were aware of an incident at Fort Raleigh, Kansas, which we were not aware of, where he actually slashed himself. The chain of command was aware of that, according to the CID report, and also an incident about 2 weeks before his death in Kuwait, which the chain of command was aware of there and actually did absolutely nothing to give him any help.
When he came home between deployments, could you see that he was in trouble?
The only thing I ever noticed was sometimes his eyes didn't look right, but I felt like, well, you know, he's been over there, he needs to unwind a little bit, and he'll be okay. But, of course, he was stationed at Fort Riley. We didn't see him a lot, but when we did see him, he seemed to be normal, but he never really made any statements of having any problems. We basically figured the Army would take care of him. That was their job.
Mm-hmm. Are you satisfied at this point with their follow-up investigation? It took a long time after Jeffrey's death, but they finally did look into it and report on it. Are you satisfied with what you've heard, Mr. Henthorne?
No, I'm not. The CID report that I have in my possession and the current also has was really an unprofessional job. I was a policeman in the Air Force and looked it over, and they pretty well glossed over most of the facts and tried to relate his death to personal problems, but in the end, the report does say the chain of command knew about his situation and did nothing. That's the bottom line in the report.
Mr. Henthorne, most people in this country are not fighting in this war. Most young men are not fighting in this war. Your son did. The charge here is that soldiers are being pushed to the front when they're not in mental condition to be there. Because of recruiting problems, because they're having to be sent again and again. You know, how do you look at his sacrifice, the sacrifice of your family, when it's this 1% of the country taking on the burden of the war?
Well, that's the problem with the public at large. There's so few civilians out here that are connected to the military. It's a different situation than when I went in 35 years ago. It was a draft. And people at home were connected with the military and paid some attention, but nowadays most people pretty well don't connect with the military the way we did. I think that's part of the problem and why pressure hadn't been brought to bear to see to it that these men aren't sent over and over again, especially. Also, the Vietnam situation, you went over there, you did your tour, you survived your tour, and you knew you were finished. But now, like the Sergeant Major was saying, sometimes four and five times they're going over there. And that's not going to work in the long run. And it comes down to a shortage of troops. I think Jeffrey's company was probably at 70% of their amount of people that they're supposed to have, and it's a continuing problem in all the companies, not just his company.
Sergeant Major Mike Lopez, what do you say to a father like Warren Henthorne who lost his son Jeffrey in this way?
Well, the first thing I'd say, first of all, I'm sorry for the loss of his son. And he's probably right. Chain of commands and leadership, command climates are different from unit to unit. And if someone recognized that there was a problem, then he should have been sent to the proper behavioral health specialist. And generally when that's done within a unit, and someone makes a recommendation that this individual either needs to be sent back to the States and chaptered out of the service, or they need to take the weapon out of his hands.
Well,
I do not know of a commander who would go against that that recommendation.
Mr. Henthorne?
Yeah, I'd say something about the chain of command. Maybe the sergeant major can elaborate. There's two chain of commands. There's a formal chain of command that you all see and are reported on. Then there's an informal chain of command, and there's where the rules are made from battalion to company, and it goes through the sergeant major down to the first shirts of the different companies, and it's not stated on black and white paper, but that is the informal rules is what counts in the service. It counted when I was in, and it counts now. The sergeants and sergeant majors and first sergeants and platoon sergeants are the ones that do the expression of the upper command. And that's just the way it is, and I think the sergeant major would have to agree.
So that the formal policy may not get enacted on the ground. In your son's case, it appears it didn't.
That's correct.
Warren Henthorne, we're very sorry for your family's loss and for Jeffrey's passing. We're grateful to you for being willing to speak about it publicly.
Yes, I give my condolences to Elizabeth also.
As do we. We wish your family the best, and we thank you for being with us today.
We'll maybe save some more soldiers by expressing and letting the public know what's going on.
We hope exactly that. Warren Henthorne in Choctaw, Oklahoma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me take a call from Buffalo, New York. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
How you doing?
We're all right.
Yeah, I was in Afghanistan 2002, and there was four of us that they made us go to Landstuhl, Germany for an evaluation. All of us were taking Larium at the time. It was right after the murders at Fort Bragg.
And what were you taking, Mike?
Larium.
Is that an antidepressant, Mike?
No, that is anti-malaria medicine.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so, anyways, I talked to the chaplain. I wasn't feeling right. I put my guns up, put my rifle up, my long gun, and my handgun.
Now, had you been in Afghanistan already when you were feeling poorly?
Yes. Yes.
And you went to the chaplain, and were you still there when you went to the chaplain?
Yes, I was in Afghanistan, and I was coming back from one of the forward operation bases, so mm-hmm. I talked to the chaplain in Bagram. I just told him I didn't feel right.
And you were serious enough about it that you put your guns aside?
I did it myself, yeah, mm-hmm. and you were supposed to be armed all the time, but mm-hmm. I just didn't feel right.
Because you were afraid you were a danger to yourself or others, Mike?
Both, mm-hmm. both. Mm-hmm. I just didn't, it's a feeling I just never had before.
And what happened?
I was starting to lose space of time, and I was getting real agitated, and matter of fact, I got a little paranoid, and yeah, I just can't explain it. It's something that never happened to me. And
how did the military respond?
Well, the guys who I was with, I was on a team of six men. They knew I was kind of, they knew I was acting strange, but yeah. Guys are tight together. They kind of just tolerate it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I was getting short-tempered and everything else, mm-hmm. and so what happened was I talked to the chaplain, and I felt better after I talked to him. And then later, a psychologist showed up who was a captain with the combat stress.
Yep.
And he talked to me, and I thought everything was fine. And then they wanted to give me some antidepressants, so they gave me some Paxil.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it takes 21 days to work. So nothing happened with that. And then after about a month, somebody showed up and said, you know, we want you to go to Landstuhl, Germany for an evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't want to go. You're not locking me up. You know, that's, you know, that's...
So you said you wanted to stay in theater, even though you were struggling with it.
Right, because if you leave, you leave your men short on your team. See, there's no draft going on, so you don't have a replacement to come in to replace you. So you feel like you're shorting your guys,
yep.
And you're letting them down.
Did they send you out anyway, Mike?
They told me, if you don't go, we're going to put you on a stretcher and make you go. In other words, strap you down, drug
right.
you up. And one
right.
guy refused to go, and that's how he went, laying down.
So,
and,
in effect, is this a success story? They responded to your trouble and got you out of there.
Well, at that time, yeah. But you know, as things progressed in 2003 in Iraq, you know, they ended up being short on people, so they weren't letting guys go. Mm-hmm. And when I got back to Fort Bragg, they made me go back to Fort Bragg because they were worrying about what happened with the three other soldiers that killed their wives.
Yes.
And so I was with the third group Special Forces. So when I got back, I went back to Bragg. I was treated at Womack Army Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they made me go to group therapy. And some of the guys, when Iraq was starting up in, was in March of 2003, a couple guys who got taken out of Afghanistan were sent to Iraq. They were told they couldn't handle a weapon at Fort Bragg. But then when the Iraq war started up, they were given a weapon and sent over there.
Mike, how are you doing now?
Huh?
How are you doing now?
I'm doing better. But, you know, that potential for violence or suicide or even homicide, when I first got back, it was there. You know, I was really
agitated. You could
feel it. And I feel for the guys, for that gentleman whose son... died
yes.
over there. I feel for him because anybody who cuts their wrist shouldn't definitely not be going over. That's a sign that man had some issues.
I would say so. We feel for him and we feel for you and appreciate your sharing your story with us, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Steve Robinson, what do you hear in this caller's story?
Well,
he was identified. He was given antidepressants. He was taken out of Afghanistan. He was given group counseling. Is this a success story?
Sure, absolutely, and we would hope that would be the norm, and I'm sure that leaders want people who are healthy warriors on the battlefield. But as the Hartford Current story and soldiers I've talked to are telling me, that's not the norm, and it really does speak to the you know, the overstretched military where soldiers are making multiple deployments. I just wanted to say, you know, there's a big difference between what DOD is reporting as casualties. Right now, I think they say there's been 19,000 global war on terror casualties as of 6706.
You're talking wounded and killed, wounded and dead.
Correct. And the VA just the other day released a document that categorizes the diseases, the illnesses, and the injuries that veterans are presenting at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And there are right now currently 56,000 people who have sought treatment at the VA for mental health care problems. So there's a big disparity in what DOD is reporting and what the VA is seeing and treating, which indicates there's a problem.
Mainly with the Iraq and Afghanistan deployments.
These are totally Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, 56,000 people.
Heather's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment and or question and concern would be that certainly, as a civilian, I am more than concerned about our soldiers' mental health and would agree that they don't need to be returning to battle if they're unfit. But then, as Mike, the soldier that spoke just before me, was saying, he felt guilty leaving because his fellow soldiers were going to be shorthanded. So it seemed to me that the answer to a lot of this is a recruitment issue. And so how do we get new soldiers out there to replace these ones who are mentally unfit to be there?
Right, because we're at war. That requires soldiers if you're going to do it. Everybody can't walk away. Heather, thanks for your call. Matt Kaufman, I can hear people thinking along those lines. I mean, if we've committed to do a war, you know, that takes soldiers. So what do you do?
I'm not sure what you do. And we, you know, the series that we wrote was sort of studiously nonpartisan and nonpolitical. And the response we got afterward sort of mostly tracked that. You know, it did not become stop bashing the war, stop bashing the president. It's sort of not the issues we were looking at. I mean, Congress can debate issues of a draft, and the military can talk about are there different things they can be doing for recruiting. The military folks that we talked to acknowledged that recruitment was part of the issue, that part of the challenge of doing appropriate mental health screening. So there's no question, as that caller said, that that's an element here.
Mike Lopez, what's your answer to this? I mean, you've described when it's done right. We've heard examples of it being done right, but clearly also there are people suffering here and there are people dying here and some fighting next to people that maybe aren't in the best shape to be there. Does it track back all the way up to recruiting? Do we need more Americans participating if we're going to stay at war this long, Sergeant Major?
In my opinion, yes. Speaking about the 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain, they're going back to back to back on deployments, and I know that's very stressful for the soldiers and the leadership that are within those units, and that's exactly right. When you're out there in combat and you have a boundary within an area of operations and you have less people to do it with, it stretches everybody, and you have less time to recuperate after a mission, and you're going right back out, and it is very stressful. And so as far as I'm concerned, the only answer is to increase the size of the force or reduce the mission. One of the two.
It's no joke when a country goes to war. Retired Command Sergeant Major Mike Lopez in Fort Drum, New York, thanks again for being with us. It's always enlightening to speak with you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Steve Robinson, final thoughts here. Where are we headed? Are we going to fix this, or is this just going to be an ongoing price paid by those who break under this strain?
Well, we're actively right now working with both people in the House and the Senate to really provide a solution to this problem. We believe the federal government, the VA, and the DOD must launch a mental health care anti-stigma campaign. The stigma associated with this war is not going to decrease without a system-wide campaign to change the perceptions and attitudes of military leaders, people in the Department of Veterans Affairs, and educating the veteran and the family. And we want there to be a campaign where soldiers will not feel guilt by seeking help. And, you know, if they get the help, many of them can return and continue to serve. And that's what we want. And we want to take care of them when they come home.
Steve Robinson with Veterans for America in Washington. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Matthew Kaufman with the Hartford Courant. Our compliments to your newspaper and to you on this reporting job. Thank you very much for bringing this to light.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.